Discourse on the Method. I'm trying to remember what I dreamed about in my room when I sat there with colitis. I think it was something like this. I was on a boat, but the boat had my childhood bedroom in it, and in my bedroom, I was swaying back and forth, and then I threw up a brown marshmallowy ball, which stuck to my hands. But my dream, unlike those of Descartes, led to no revelation and no great work to come, just more anxiety and stomach pain. I mean, I still have colitis, and I still enjoy being alone, and that's pretty much my version of analytical geometry. Chapter 6. The Teen Years, or How I Failed Hosting a Bar Mitzvah Party. Teen years are frequently beset with failure, so I realize it's a gray area for me because, by definition, teens are, on the whole, a hot mess, and, as a matter of course, so was I. I have a teenage son right now, and he's mainly an angry cur who eats Cheetos all day and regularly slams doors, not a metaphor. For example, if I left my son at home with his friends in our apartment for more than 4 hours, all the food would be eaten, like all of it, including the dry goods. The furniture would be tossed and turned over, and at least one of the kids would have a head injury or worse. And there would be puddles of piss on the bathroom floor. And one of them would have mixed all the available liquids, including cleaning products, together in a bowl, along with creams and powders and old paint to try and make a bomb. Teens are this grisly combination of suppressed rage, sexual confusion, vanity, and unrelenting incompetence. But there may be a redeeming sweetness there, somewhere, buried very deep. Just imagine Donald Trump, but more agile. Or a turkey vulture. There's a constant war between needing affirmation and shunning affirmation. My first connection, and many teens' first connections besides with one another, was with music. So, music and friends became this identity Venn diagram, and when I entered the seventh grade, music became a driving factor in how I defined myself and how I was perceived by others. I can't put my finger on it or how it all started, but I began to like disco. Honestly, it was not a popular choice amongst most of the people I knew. Like I previously mentioned, my father is a jazz fan and my mother was a ballet dancer, so she listens to primarily classical. My sister, at the time, was into folk and folk rock. Her album collection was a lot of Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, America, Linda Ronstadt, that kind of stuff. And Worcester was not a welcoming place for disco. I think it started because I went to visit my friend while he was at theater camp, and I met a girl whose father was the head of Casablanca Records. Or, a girl lied that her father was the head of Casablanca Records, and she played some records for me, like Donna Summer and Funky Town, and I believe we kissed. Therefore, I really liked disco. And disco was a slippery slope. It was a direct line to roller skating, and that was a very dangerous line to draw. Roller rinks were like Planned Parenthood. Kids who hated disco and roller disco would hang outside roller rinks to jeer at the kids who went in. So the one place young disco lovers could gather was heavily targeted by anti-disco mobs. The main enemy to disco was rock and roll fans, or burnouts. Burnouts were 13-year-old pack-a-day smokers who wore denim and only listened to Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and maybe T-Rex. Double burnouts listened to stadium rock, but also dabbled in metal, like Black Sabbath or Judas Priest. The Bruce Springsteen crowd was also squarely anti-disco and wore less denim, but still quite a bit of denim, and more baseball caps. Burnouts would never wear baseball caps. Even punk was represented, but punk rockers were like the Amish. They weren't missionary. They just hated everybody equally and kept to themselves. So how did one manifest the disco lifestyle from ages 12 to 16, the pre-club and pre-cocaine-sniffing demographic of disco listeners? Mainly buying 45s and feathering one's hair. Slacks were a part of it, but I never really got involved in the fashion. Going full disco was an invitation to bodily harm. And Worcester was no Stonewall. Anti-gay sentiment was rampant. I can't even imagine what it was like growing up gay in central Massachusetts in the 70s, but I had a small taste by liking disco. Jewfag was a very popular thing to call me in the 7th and 8th grade, and that was primarily by teachers. Also, I could dance. The capacity to do the disco splits was a big asset to have in the disco community, and because I inherited a little of my mother's dance ability, I could pull off the disco splits, including with roller skates on, a real advantage. And that feeling of total confidence within the sacred confines of the rink with the colored lights flashing and he's the greatest dancer pulsating, am I pulling off a seamless disco split down and instantly back up? Fucking heaven. But then came the cold blast of punishing reality, leaving the rink, realizing that disco was a hermetic world roundly hated by the outside world. They didn't want us to roller dance. They didn't want us to fluidly move our bodies and feel the wind in our heavily sprayed feathered hair. Look, the bottom line is, disco was not a masculine musical form. I don't think disco was ever used in a war movie, a bunch of soldiers blasting Ring My Bell while gearing up for a battle. The negative backlash of my pro-disco stance was pretty harsh. I was punched in the stomach at school by some pointed enemies who were radical in their animosity toward disco. This became a day-to-day issue for me. One particularly chubby rock supremacist would chase me around school to try and rough me up, but fortunately I was too quick to get caught. Still, it took an emotional toll. At a pizza parlor, I got cornered by two Led Zeppelin lovers. They poured the salt and pepper shakers over my head, threw my sub sandwich on the ground, and stepped on it and said, "Fuck disco." Another time, my friend Nathan and I biked in the woods to smoke cigarettes, and we made the dubious choice of riding Nathan's mom's tandem bike. We were, unbeknownst to us, followed by a group of kids on dirt bikes who found us in a clearing, sitting on a rock, smoking, and listening to disco on a transistor radio. Not a great look. They destroyed the bike and the radio and beat us both up. That was a long walk home, carrying a busted-up tandem bike. But that was the price to pay for smoking to disco. Threats of violence notwithstanding, the silver lining was that disco dancing was a popular pastime at bar mitzvah parties. And because I was a competent dancer, like I said, I was at least good at a party. Bar mitzvah parties were also my first foray into sexual experimentation. It was like junior swinging. But because I was, quote-unquote, disco, negotiating these parties was very treacherous. Most of the kids all attended the same parties, and therefore, I was an easy target at each and every one. Many of those parties involved a kind of stealth blending in, mixed with a hyper-vigilance because you never knew when contra forces would strike and just start throwing punches. This strategy got more and more problematic as parties continued, culminating in a real showdown at the Bancroft Ballroom late in the bar mitzvah season. It was a run-of-the-mill bar mitzvah party with all the usual suspects in a hotel ballroom with a DJ playing music and games. I was on the make with this girl in my class when I got word that a disco hater was waiting outside the door, so if and when I left, he was going to kill me. It was like a mob hit, except the mobsters had just finished a hula hoop contest. There was only one exit, so I quickly realized I was trapped. Melancholia set in as I realized what my disco life hath wrought. I wearily contemplated my future never-ending struggles to live in peace with my syncopated beat and groovy bass lines. But for now, there was just a dark foreboding of a life spent pointing my finger at the sky, then down at the ground in a diagonal motion, repeated again and again, only in the shadows. So, after feeling too sorry for myself, the party was all but empty, and I was sitting against the wall, mired in panic. I think I might have even started to cry. Disco lovers aren't afraid to cry in fear. And then, from above, he appeared. He was a boy. His name was Chuck, and he had blonde hair and a buzz cut that looked slightly white supremacist. He looked like a character out of a photo from the 50s where he might have been holding a "We won't go to school with Negroes" poster. He was unusually large for 13. He said he had heard what was going on and told me he would escort me out, a real my bodyguard moment. I didn't really know him that well, and I wasn't sure why he was helping me, but he made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I gathered myself and followed him out. He stopped me before the exit and said, "You go first." I asked, "Why? The kid is out there." He said, "You'll see." The kid, who was waiting, was still there, and as I walked out, he looked at me like an animal that hadn't been fed. He started toward me quick, and then Chuck came out and walked right between us, almost on cue, abruptly halting the kid's advance. Chuck looked down at the kid and simply said, "Hey." The kid looked up in soul-crushing defeat. Chuck signaled with his eyes for me to walk on. I don't think I ever felt more vindicated in my life as I walked by that sour kid who rained on my Bancroft bar mitzvah party, who knew in one instant that all that waiting for me was for naught. I took my time striding by, soaking in the moment. I asked Chuck why he did it, why he helped me, and he quietly said, "I like disco." My own bar mitzvah party was going to be the best one of the year for one simple reason, a disco ball. Yes, a disco ball, the sun of the disco solar system. My father, from his lighting supply store, brought one home. It by no means made up for the fact that my party was to be in the basement of my mother's dance studio, but like I said, I had a disco ball, and how many people have a personal disco ball? Maybe at the Neverland Ranch? Maybe the publisher of Hustler's apartment? Maybe Halston's yacht? Maybe Saddam Hussein's torture room? John Travolta's steam room? Or John Travolta's torture room? Maybe Dennis Hopper's van? Or Gore Vidal's home gym? Possibly Henry Kissinger's man cave? Anyway, access to party lighting was the first real perk, besides decent housing and an education and a YMCA membership, of my father's vocation. He hung it in the center of the room, turned off all the lights, and tried it out. And suddenly, this musty basement became a musty basement splattered with constantly moving patterns of silver light. I stood and paid witness to this otherworldly display, awed by the possibilities of all my secret fantasies realized. A private disco paradise. My parents had made an agreement to stay upstairs during the party, and they had arranged for the DJ and some snacks and party favors. This was going to be like if Studio 54 and a Hebrew school had a baby. The DJ arrived, and he seemed a little older than the DJs at most of the other parties I had been to, but no bother. The pool of available bar mitzvah DJs in the Worcester area couldn't be that large. He set up some albums and plugged in his equipment while some of the kids started to arrive. The small disco light in the center of this beige-painted cinder block room was spinning, and it must have looked like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was having their holiday party. The DJ started to speak, and he introduced himself to the kids and mentioned he was the afternoon DJ at 14Q, which was the local oldie station. Wait, the DJ was from 14Q? It was the station my parents listened to. Sinatra came on. Not kidding. Summer Wind, I believe. Not Earth, Wind, and Fire, but Summer Wind. Kids were confused and milling about. Summer Wind played out and seamlessly transitioned into The Best Is Yet to Come by Tony Bennett, with a slow, sappy intro from the DJ about my becoming a man. It was clear now my parents had hired an AM oldies DJ. Also, no party games, no limbo, musical chairs, or anything, just music from the soundtrack to Showboat. So despite the promise of the disco ball, my bar mitzvah party was more like a wedding at Mar-a-Lago than a kid's disco party. I politely asked the DJ if he had anything more modern to play, and he pulled out a few albums like Chicago and John Denver. John Denver? Playing John Denver at a bar mitzvah would be like playing the Village People at a funeral, with the key exception of one of the members of the Village People's funeral, in which case it would be more than appropriate to play the Village People. Although it does allow for the possibilities of a Rocky Mountain Chai joke. But this DJ didn't tell jokes. The party limped on, with kids standing around to the oldies. Chuck showed up, and I was mortified. He had saved me because of disco, and this is how I repaid him? My disco bodyguard stood there listening to Nat King Cole looking disappointed. He did give me my favorite gift, though, $13 in $1 bills. There was something memorably poignant about that gift. It should be the model for all gifts. I got a lot of silver pen sets and Israeli savings bonds, but $13 in ones was by far the standout. Kids started leaving early. Chuck left. The party ended with me and a few kids in the other room, while the DJ played his tunes to the revolving, spectral gleam of the disco ball alone until he packed up his gear and left quietly into the AM waves of the night. At least my parents didn't hire a talk radio DJ, although talk radio might have been a little more festive. Chapter 7 Shelves, or How I Failed to Star in a Pornographic Movie. My father had a real throbbing work ethic. Can I put it like that? I guess I did, because it was powerful and strong, but at the same time it reverberated. If his work ethic was a sound, it would be a foghorn. Nice to hear in the fog, and helpful to the safety of fellow travelers, but hard to sleep to. I've always felt both admiration for and aggravation by his steady dose of principled hard work. I guess you could say he's the ocean in our volatile post-climate change world, and I'm the seawall. He is a force that, in time, slowly erodes away all that resists. I know that sounds like an insult, but honestly it's more of a tribute. But at best, we worked at cross-purposes. I was the yawn to his yang. Get it? To be blunt, he was industrious, and I was sluggish. Am sluggish. I like to think that our master-apprentice relationship just went sideways, which is at least not down. Still, he tried. As mentioned, he owned an electrical supply business, and that left open many opportunities for me to work there or help out on weekends. I was a pitiable employee. I was like the Billy Carter of the place, a fun-loving embarrassment. People liked me, but I was completely inept at carrying out simple tasks. I broke more bulbs than I sold, and lost many customers by wandering about the warehouse, trying to find inventory without a clue where it was. Work was like a foreign language to me, which was all the more curious considering how easily it came to my father. I was good for a little light conversation and made a relatively easygoing lunch companion, and I could definitely nap at will. The ability to snap-nap served me well in future employment. I remember once I took an order at the counter of my dad's store, and the next thing I remember, I was woken up in a large box on the floor. I had actually taken a customer order, started to fill it, then found a box to take a nap in, never to return to the customer. That pretty much sums up my work ethic. My father's ceaseless attempts to right my ship led him to outsource my services to another company, a friend of his who ran a fledgling commercial phone installation business. This was more likely than not some underhanded Trojan horse-style attack on this man, considering how detrimental I was to my dad's company's bottom line. My task was to build shelves in his new warehouse space to store his cable and wire and other inventory. A big task for a 16-year-old with no carpentry skills whatsoever. The kicker was that I was working alone, with no help or supervision. Supplies were provided, including the lumber and tools to make the shelves. I had the whole summer, but time wasn't germane in this practical experiment. It felt more like a thought experiment, like Schrödinger's cat. But in this case, if a boy is put in a room alone for 2 months with materials to build shelves, with no ability to build shelves, is it only to serve to illustrate how a random subatomic event that may or may not happen in this room or outside renders the point of the task moot? Thereby, is there even a task at all if it can't be performed? Or can there be no task and a task simultaneously? For about a week, I sat next to a pile of wood and listened to the radio in a state of quasi-suspended animation. I knew I couldn't start because then I would have to finish, and I knew that would be pointless since I would then have to answer for my work, which would have been definitely not shelves. Better to just wait. I thought maybe I could better explain having done nothing than try to justify the work I would have done. This convoluted logic was something of a comfort to me. And no one ever came around, so I was really in the groove. After a few weeks, I moved the wood around a bit and set up something of a model of where the shelves would be. It was more as if like a toddler had been told to make shapes out of some wood. A guy who worked for the boss came by and looked at my work thus far, and he shockingly gave his approval, a keep it up. As I explained to him, so yeah, I've basically set up the outline where the shelves will go, and then I'll start building them up, but I'm basically pretty sure I will build this, you know, basic setup unless it changes, which I doubt, but I just want to make sure the plan works best before I really get the shelves up, right? Sounds good. I'll tell Barry. Oh, yeah. I'm hoping to really get started quickly now that I'm all good with the setup. Yeah, all right then. But based on this, it could change, as in orient this way instead of that, right? Yeah, that could work. Good, I just want to make sure this works best for the shelves, because, you know, you only get one shot at this. Yep, back to work. Yeah, me too, with the shelves. I knew now that stalling was my best quality and the best hope for a reasonable excuse to never build anything. An acceptable non-conclusion for this job. So, the plan was as follows. I would keep moving the wood around in different configurations and would keep this up as long as possible. In the event of another supervisor coming by, I would state that I'd change the plan so as to maximize the best outcome for the shelves. Hopefully, this would get me through the next few months. At least, that was the goal. So I went back to listening to the radio and sipping iced tea. Another stretch of time where I was never visited, just me alone with my wood. And then, one morning, quite early, a van pulled up and changed everything. A man exited, with ankles shackled, led out of the van by some sort of uniformed guard. Barry, the boss, was there along with a couple of other employees. They signed some paperwork, and then he was led over to me.
This is Jerry Franklin. He's going to be working with you for the rest of the summer.
Jerry was smiling but had no teeth. He appeared to be either in his late 20s or his early 60s. Hard to tell based on the lack of teeth. I just shook his hand.
Jerry is on our work release program from the Walpole Penitentiary, and he'll be with you till 5 every day. You know, John, show him around and what you're working on, and he'll work with you on the project.
And that was that. Everyone basically went their separate ways, and there I stood with Jerry from the Walpole prison. You know that feeling when you realize you have to spend an entire summer with a convicted felon? That's how I felt. The upside's right off. He was very friendly. I'm guessing getting out of jail puts one in a good mood. So chipper he was, and talkative. I had been talking to a pile of wood for the last 3 weeks, so company was welcomed. Also, the way he talked, having no teeth, makes people sound funny, and he did, like Walter Brennan singing Old Rivers. There was a lot of excitable lisping. The last, and for obvious selfish reasons, was that now somebody could actually build the shelves, which was a major relief considering I was increasingly on edge about the inevitable showdown with Barry when I would have had to confess that I couldn't build shelves. So I took the good with the bad in this case. Jerry had to be good with his hands, right? If you can murder, there's a good shot you're handy. And look, I was not aware he was a murderer, yet, but I was curious, considering I was alone in a warehouse with him, surrounded by things to murder with, like hammers and nail guns and saws and screwdrivers and table saws and shovels and wire to strangle with and heavy-duty garbage bags to put me in. Jerry cased the place and stood around the huge collection of wire on spools which were accumulating in one corner of the warehouse and the reasons the shelves were being built to store the wire.
That's a lot of wire.
Yeah.
You got a car?
Yeah.
Cool.
The next day, the prison van pulled up and Jerry bounded out, bound. He looked extra happy, that big gummy smile. I hadn't exactly slept knowing I was working again with Jerry. He had told me that he was in jail on drug charges and, quote-unquote, some other stuff. So it was still up in the air what other stuff meant.
Gonna be a busy day today.
Yeah. Jerry was lanky and strong and very jumpy like a puppy. He did have this positive energy and that cut against my paranoia. Can you build shelves? I asked. He laughed.
I can't build shit.
Oh, I assumed you could build. That's why they brought you here?
No, man. I'm here because the guy who knows Barry put in a word for me and helped me set this up.
Oh, because I'm supposed to build the shelves in here.
Oh, well, I can help.
Well, I don't know how to build shelves.
Oh, did you tell them?
No, not yet. He laughed.
Is there nobody around here?
No, pretty much just me all day, every day.
So, you don't do nothing?
Not really. Jerry laughed hard again.
That's something.
He looked around.
Okay, well, here's what we can do.
He led me over to the spools of copper wire and enlisted me to cut small lengths off each spool and put them in a box. Then, he instructed me to take the box into my car.
At lunch, we'll go to the scrap metal yard.
I didn't question it, and it wasn't like I was going to take some righteous stance to a guy from Walpole who I had to work with all day, every day for the rest of the summer.
It's just some clippings. We won't get in trouble.
I drove him to the yard, and we sold the copper clippings for around $6 or $7. He was beaming. On the way back, he did the math. $6 to $7 a day, at around 3 days a week, so as not to arouse suspicion, would net him close to $25 a week, which apparently was a haul in prison. I was hesitant to make this a regular thing. Jerry, why don't I give you some money every week, since I get paid, and then we won't do this anymore, since we could get in trouble, you know, if we get caught.
No, that's crazy. I ain't taking your money. We gotta earn it.
I didn't really understand the reasoning, but again, he was in jail for some other stuff, so I decided not to voice my dissent. After a few weeks, Jerry and I settled into a pretty comfortable relationship. He was making boku money from his copper scheme, and I was enabling his satisfaction. I started to realize that the more he was out of prison, the more I was in prison, doing his bidding every day, buying his lunches and driving him to sell the wire snippets. I was basically his prison bitch. But, like the majority of prison bitches, I was content as long as the relationship remained uncomplicated. He regaled me with tales of how he was spending his money in jail, you know, cigarettes and top ramen. Very short stories. He was on the rise at Walpole, and I was helping, and he was generous with his praise. So I was basically abetting a very, very small criminal enterprise and essentially getting nothing out of it. It was like a really anemic Bronx tale. And on top of it all, no shelves. About a week after, Jerry was in an excitable mood, and he said he had big plans for lunch.
Today we're going to go to my cousin's for lunch.
What?
I spoke to my cousin on the phone, and we're going to go for lunch.
Okay. We drove to a three-decker not far from where we worked and walked up a half-flight of concrete steps to the ground-floor apartment unit. A woman opened the door and hugged Jerry. He introduced me as we walked into the apartment. She was in tight jean shorts and a tank top and maybe was in her mid-twenties. I don't remember her name, so let's just call her the cousin. We stood around for a minute in her kitchen and chatted. There was a smell that was unpleasant, but I was just trying to be polite and process the thought of eating lunch there. There were dirty dishes in the sink and a general vibe of uncleanliness. Jerry then told her to get changed, so she went in the bedroom. It was, for sure, a curious moment. Are we going out, Jerry?
No. Do you want to fuck her?
What?
On film.
On film?
Yeah, I set it all up.
Wait, set up what?
Set up to record you and my cousin in a bedroom. We made it look like a hotel room.
Wait, what?
Yeah, a porno about you and her fucking in a hotel room.
Decent plot, but what made you think I would want to do a porn movie, Jerry?
You don't? No!
Now the cousin came out wearing a robe.
He just wanted to do it,
Jerry blurted. I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was being brought here to do this. I think I had had sex once before, and that can best be described as my penis going into a girl's vagina for a second and a half before I abruptly pulled it out and ejaculated onto my parents' white shag rug. So now, technically, the second time, if agreed upon, would be on camera with Jerry from Walpole Prison and his cousin. I also didn't know a great deal about the porn industry, but I didn't think it was done on this scale. She handed Jerry a pre-tied bow tie. Jerry put it on.
I was gonna be the bellhop!
There was a part of me that most certainly was interested in the proposition of doing it. I was 16. I was horny often enough without the opportunity of ever doing pornography, and as far as life-changing offers, this was definitely one, whether good or abysmally bad. There were too many questions, though. Did they have decent distribution? Would I receive an ownership stake? Was the cousin a patient lover? Do people enjoy watching less than 3 seconds of intercourse? Would this hurt my career opportunities both in and out of pornography?
Well?
So, Jerry, what happens?
I show you into a room as a bellhop, holding this bottle of champagne, and then you two go fuck on the bed.
The cousin stared out blankly as if pondering her character's motivation. It was a deceivingly simple storyline. Couple goes into a hotel room. So many title possibilities. Hotel? Motel 69? The Comer's Suite? A room with a Jew? Turn on service? Go down service? Dial B for boner? I know that's not technically hotel related, but I like it. I looked over at Jerry with his bow tie hanging loosely over his dirty t-shirt and his come hither and fuck my cousin grin, and I had a real thought to do it, if only for Jerry. I mean, I pretty much already did everything for him. And what were the consequences if I said no? Would Jerry kill me because I wouldn't have sex with his cousin? I was beginning to enter my danger zone, that place where I need a paper bag to breathe into so as not to keel over. I said the first thing I could think of. I'll be the bellhop. I realized only after sputtering this out the ramifications of all this. In essence, it involved a cute way out for me, but via a wildly unorthodox scenario. Jerry fucks his cousin. When I realized what I'd suggested, I became even more tense, as in, was he going to kill me for even floating the idea of incest on tape? He looked over at his cousin, and she looked at him. There was no light bulb moment, but they did look at each other for an extended amount of time. 20 minutes later, I entered the cousin's bedroom with a pre-tied bow tie around my neck and delivered the line, "Your champagne, sir." An hour after that, I was back at the warehouse with Jerry, sitting next to a pile of wood, listening to the radio. We never finished the shelves. We tried. We built a portion of them. I hope they kept them, because they were more public art than shelves. Jerry got in the van that last day of our job, and he turned around and smiled and waved. Even though he fucked his cousin, I knew I would miss him. In any event, it was shot on beta, and it's out there somewhere. If any of you listeners are diehard porn aficionados, keep your eyes peeled for the 16-year-old bellhop. Chapter 8. The Threesome, or How I Failed to Quantify It. There are different kinds of ménage à trois experiences. To be brief, I'll break them down into three categories. The intellectual threesome, the classic threesome, or the Benjamin threesome. For the intellectual threesome, Carl Jung and his wife Emma and Tony Wolfe serve as a prime example. Wolfe was a student of Jung's and became his lover. The relationship took place over several decades and became deeply personal and involved. It was, as I understand, primarily sexual to start, but it evolved into a binding, evocative, and complex triad that fueled both discord and intellectual rigor. The classic threesome is more immediate and short-lived and involves, as a matter of course, clear liquor and lube. The Benjamin threesome is altogether unique. Threesomes are not always smooth, or at least mine wasn't. For some people, threesomes are totally natural. I've talked to people who speak of them like they are not awkward at all, like, "Hey, I hooked up with these two girls last night and it was totally sweet." Or, "I met these two guys at a bar and we went back to my place and went at it." Or, "When I was in Canada, I had a threesome with this member of the House of Commons and his wife. It was really cool." I bristle at sexual openness and easygoing attitudes. For me, sex has always been an intensely anxiety-provoking proposition. Maybe it was the way I was raised, feral, by wolves, wild, heathen sex wolves. Watching those wild wolves go at it all night and day can affect a child's disposition on sexual mores. Sex is admittedly problematic for a lot of people, so I'm not a total anomaly. I'm a second-guesser when it comes to sexual behavior. There's a lot of fits and starts with me, like fussing about and excusing myself a lot to go to the bathroom. It may just be a general lack of confidence, but is any of this turning you on? I remember the first time a girl reached down my pants in the basement of my house. I seized up so fast, I thought my appendix had burst. It took like 3 weeks for the pain to go away. It was like the devil himself had stuck his pitchfork into my spleen to teach me not to be touched there. Like the ladies used to say to me, "You're a real Johnny Cotton in the sack." Although I have made slight progress over the years, intimacy is not my strong suit, but I've learned to work with the tools I have. As you can imagine, I'm not particularly adventurous. Even missionary is a bit much for me. My first trip to a porn theater resulted in me throwing out my shoes after because I thought they may give me gonorrhea just from the floor. Part of this may be the product of genetic behavior, as in some people are more sexually open than others, or it may have been a product of that one time in eighth grade during a JV basketball game when I was subbed into the game and got a spontaneous erection. A big moment for me, finally getting to play in a game, and a devastating and curious response, my public erection. It was the saddest timeout ever called. Of course, the backlash was spectacular, with the entire school giving me the timeout gesture for the rest of the year wherever I went. I attended a small New England college, you know, the one with the stone buildings and the obligatory all-white student population. Except for that one kid. Actually, my roommate my first year was one of the very few Hispanic kids on campus, and simply by random selection, I was introduced in a deeper sense to a completely different culture than mine. He was from Spanish Harlem, and I learned so much from him, including how to press Jordache jeans, as well as a completist familiarity with the Roxanne Wars. He also introduced me to systemic racism, and I got to see it almost every day, unfurl before my eyes. The most revealing part was that he loved it there. This was, to me, a confusing reaction, but it was his way. Making the best of things is not a quality of the privileged class. Freshman year in college was predominantly an experiment in poorly mixed cocktails and clumsy sexual liaisons with a sprinkle of astronomy and Victorian literature. The most awkward feature of most sexual encounters, at least in my dorm room, was that they were performed not by me, but in my presence by my roommate. There's no better ambient oral experience than to fall asleep to other people fucking. It was such sweet relief to hear it end. And just as the room became quiet in that post-coital glow, and I was finally ready to let sleep take me, they would start up again. My roommate had real stamina. I think we even had a conversation about negotiating down the amount of times he could have repeated sex in the room with me there. Like, it's okay to have it, but can you try to have it maybe no more than twice? I have a 9 a.m. lecture. Also, maybe I'm an old-fashioned sort, but sex should be between a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, or a man and a man, or a man and a doll, but not in front of a man or a woman. I considered going the it-happened-one-night route and putting up a sheet, but then I also would have needed sound baffling. But this was the general nature of college sexual behavior. It was a bit circus-like, in that people would have sex like elephants, as in anywhere they could at any time, with no trainer to whip them to stop. As an upperclassman, I lived in a prison cell-sized concrete block dorm room with a Cure poster and a mini-fridge. A guy down the hall was a strapping guy who played on the college soccer team. He was handsome, charming, athletic, a smooth talker, and an all-around popular type. I had none of his magnetism. One night, he brought in a girl from another dorm, and we sat around chatting and drinking. The conversation quickly drifted to sex, and he rather blithely proposed that the three of us all have it. This suggestion was like a shotgun got rung off next to my ear. Fortunately, she, like me, seemed not interested. But he was persistent and began this long, inspiring stump speech in favor of group sex. He went on and on about doing things that are memorable and extraordinary, and that we wouldn't regret this choice, but rather would celebrate it later as an emblem of free spirit, and moments like this should never be left undone. He was like the threesome wrangler. And how many times had he delivered that speech? It was way too polished to have been extemporaneous. I was nervously giggling a lot and was at least comforted by her expression, which was a mix of nice try and holy shit, what a creep. Then there was a pause, and she looked at us and said very plainly, "I'll go up and put in my diaphragm." She quickly exited. Stunning development. He casually started undressing with just me in the room. I started to flop sweat. Deep panic. He was suddenly just in his underwear, and I was pacing back and forth like a barrister, prattling on about why we shouldn't do this. He was pretty unfazed by my nervous breakdown. I just hoped she would never come back. Then, a knock. She entered. Fuck! She looked over at him, and they started immediately kissing. He led her to my bed and gestured for me to come over. I complied like an old dog when its owner snaps, slowly loping over toward the bed. He took her shirt off, and I sat awkwardly at the edge of the bed and started stroking her torso like it was a snapping turtle. Reluctantly, I lay down next to her and took off my shirt. It was like I had rigor mortis. They were quickly naked and stacked on top of each other, and I was, like, half off the bed, looking at the ceiling, trying to conjure invisibility. Soon enough, they were having sex, and less remembered I was there. For a good 15 minutes, I tried to make myself as small and inconspicuous as possible, while pressing against two people making love in different positions. It was the porn version of the movie Ghost. I remember, after we finished, putting on my shirt and saying that I should go take a shower. So there was born the Benjamin threesome. Technically, a twosome with a twist. Or, like Canadian doubles, if one person didn't have a racket. My threesome happened fairly spontaneously, but there is a praxis for general application. Just get three people and have one casually observe any two from very close range. Chapter 9. How I failed to provide a historical example of failure. Okay, so I feel like we are at the point in the book where we need to get serious about the principles of failure from a less anecdotal perspective and get to something more objective. This would obviously require more specific examples of failure in history and how we can use those examples to better understand the nature of failure. But because I don't have the tools to provide you with any actual careful historical analysis, I decided to reach out to a professional historian so as to cite pertinent examples. This benefits both of us because we can learn together. Instead of characterizing his research, I will just share our correspondence. This will be the best way to get the full benefit of a more analytical approach to failure. I reached out to classics professor from NYU, Andrew Monson. Andrew, I know this is a bit out of the blue, but I am writing a comedy book about personal failure for Dutton, and I wanted to reach out to see if you could take some time to discuss a particular person from antiquity, Roman or otherwise, who personifies failure. It would preferably be someone not well known so I can tell their story for a segment in the book. Any chance we could get in touch, or perhaps you could steer me to someone who could help? Thanks for your time, H. John Benjamin. Dear John, there was a recent book arguing that Alexander the Great was a great failure, but that, of course, deliberately runs counter to what he personifies to most people. And he's by no means a poorly known figure. He was too obsessed with drinking and conspiracy theories to secure his empire. It's hard to think of anyone who at the same time sticks out as a personification of failure and is poorly known. The Roman agrarian reformers failed, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, and the late Roman emperors failed to keep out the Germanic invaders. Some of the Macedonian kings in the dynasty of Cleopatra were ridiculed in antiquity and blamed for Egypt's downfall. I have a hunch you might be looking for a literary character, and being a historian, I'm perhaps not the best person to ask. Best wishes, Andrew. Andrew, thanks for getting back. Is there a pivotal moment where someone, by not acting, caused a sea change in politics or jeopardized the stability of the empire or republic? I know this is a very general question, but I'm just trying to pin down for clarity what I'm going for. It can be a historical figure who failed in a big way in one moment, as opposed to looking at it from a whole career perspective. John. Dear John, I would like to help, but my teaching and research schedule leaves me little time. Good luck with the book, and hopefully you can find someone to help with your endeavor. Best, Andrew. Andrew, again, thanks for getting back. I don't mean to keep pestering, but I do have a whole section of a book to write, and deadlines are piling up. I realize you are a busy professor, but I figure you must have, at minimum, one example so I can pass that on to my readers. Thanks again for the time. John. Dear John, there are numerous books on the subject that can provide you a broad array of examples. I would suggest perhaps taking a look at some more comprehensive studies to give you a sense of the history and the characters who drove it, and that may pay dividends in finding a subject. Depending on your interests and how familiar you are with Roman history, you could pick a few from among. The Fall of the Roman Republic by David Schotter. Outlines of Roman History by William C. Morey. History of Rome by Michael Grant. Rome in the Late Republic by Mary Beard and Michael Crawford. The Romans, From Village to Empire by Mary T. Boatwright. A History of the Roman People by Alan Ward. The Roman Revolution by Ronald Seem. The Last Generation of the Roman Republic by Eric S. Gruen. I found H.H. Scullard's From the Gracchi to Nero impossibly soporific and dull. And Edward Gibbon, although enjoyable enough, would probably lead you astray, as his history is really more of an indictment of Christianity than anything else. In other words, Gibbon is not a place to start to learn Roman history. It reads more like a polemic than history, more Voltaire than Michelet. Best, Andrew. Dear Andrew, look, I don't have time to read any of these, and to be honest, I'm just looking for you to write 4 to 5 pages of the book to provide an example for my readers. There are a lot of failures out there who are counting on some historical background, and I don't want to get prickly, but maybe I should have been more direct earlier on what I needed. Can you at least write a few paragraphs on any subject you pick, and I'll just add some stuff to extend it to like 5 pages. I assume you're good at this kind of thing. John, I can't just provide you material for your book. It would be a breach of ethics. As I stated, I believe it would be best to get in touch with someone else. Best, Andrew. Andrew, you were the only one to write back. I wrote a bunch of classics professors, and none have returned my emails. I'm not going to lie. It would be easier if you just wrote something, and I will credit you in the book. And that way we would be clear of any ethical questions. It would be a huge help. Thanks. Maybe that agrarian reformer you talked about, Gaius Gracchus, maybe him? John. Dear John, please cease contact with me in regards to this matter. Best, Andrew. Chapter 10. Dihar, or How I Failed to Move to France. I love the movie 5 Easy Pieces. Let me backtrack. I am pretentious. When I was in college, I read Camus, but I didn't really understand him. I just knew he was one of those authors deep thinkers would appreciate. Existentialism as a philosophical movement was a wellspring for pretensioneers like me. It was because its emblem was nonverbal brooding, so discourse could be avoided, i.e., I rarely had to back it up. I was so bad at branding that my version of being an existentialist was forcing myself to read The Stranger, and then reading the first 40 pages of The Plague. And then, the real pièce de résistance, classic pretentious move, by the way, to overuse French idioms, buying a Camus t-shirt. I mean, that is real Mall of America-level existentialism. I didn't even have the balls to don a beret, or wear all black, or smoke a pipe. Just a red t-shirt with Camus' face on it. And the problem was, there's a built-in conflict in wearing the Camus t-shirt because, at the most basic level, the t-shirt is an invitation for like-minded Camus fans to spot me and then spark a dialogue. And this is the real enemy of the pretensioneer. Real, deep, meaningful conversation on the topic they pretend to embrace. The hope was, at best, to meet people with no interest in Camus who I could at least establish a false sense of superiority over and then go from there. Sample dialogue as follows. Girl, pointing at t-shirt. Who's that? Me. Oh, it's my favorite author, Albert Camus. Girl. Oh. Me. Yeah, have you read The Stranger? Girl. No. Me. Oh, you have to. It's essential existentialism. Girl. Cool. Me. I'm an existentialist, basically. I mean, that feeling of being totally autonomous, untethered. It is that all-encompassing feeling of pure dread and pure freedom feeding off each other. It's about being totally self-aware and totally authentic. I hate people who can't see that our natural state of being is being totally alone in the universe. Girl. Right. Me. So, do you want to hang out sometime? After I left school in 1989, I decided to move to France, the ultimate pretensioneer power move. Fake it till you really fake it. Without that feeling of disconnectedness to my world, the move was largely the fulfillment of what the Camus t-shirt had done on a small scale. I was getting serious about my pretentiousness and putting my money where my mouth was. So with that in mind, I asked my parents to pay for it. Appropriately, they refused, so I took a job at my father's store and a side job at a chain restaurant in Worcester called Charlie's Eating and Drinking Saloon, home of the sizzling fajita. In a somewhat related failure, my stint at Charlie's Saloon only lasted a few months because of my sincere inability to deliver the fajita sizzling, which was the whole raison d'être, did it again, of the sizzling fajita. I mainly delivered them non-sizzling due to my severely slow reaction time. The sizzle was created by the cook hitting the pile of meat and peppers with hot oil while the plate sat on the expedite counter, and the waiters were meant to swoop in and rush them to the tables. Here's a snippet of conversation between myself and the manager that would commonly occur due to overtly poor fajita serving aptitude.
How do we deliver the fajita?
Sizzling.
Right. Do we ever deliver a fajita that's not sizzling?
No.
What happens when a fajita is not sizzling?
We bring them back.
And whose salary does that come out of?
Mine.
Right. But what never happens?
The fajita isn't sizzling.
Yes. The fajitas are never not sizzling when they hit the table.
And after many non-sizzlers, the following conversation.
What's going on?
Nothing.
How many fajitas have you delivered in the last week?
50, maybe.
And how many were sizzling?
Most of them.
Practically none of them!
I don't think so.
I think so, because I'm the one who gets the complaints!
Maybe they're not smoking real good when I drop some, but there's definitely sizzle.
What did I tell you when you started here?
Deliver the fajitas sizzling.
Charlie's is known for their sizzling fajitas. That's what works. People come here from all over the area to enjoy them.
Right.
Deliver them sizzling.
I was on borrowed time from the beginning at Charlie's. I just wasn't fast enough, hungry enough, in it to win it enough. But I raised enough money to buy a ticket to Paris with money left over to last a good month. I would be like Hemingway, but instead of hooking up with Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, and Picasso, my sole contact was a friend of my Aunt Marion's who owned a knick-knack shop, more last generation than lost generation. Although, my aunt was a wonderfully eccentric woman who traveled a lot, so my hope was that her contact might prove interesting. I boarded my one-way flight with big hopes of leaving all that broken America had brought me, to live out my days wandering the streets and parks of Paris, a true bohemian. After taking the metro into the city, I had the address of the hotel I had booked for the first few nights before I had to hustle an apartment or a long-term place to stay. When I arrived, it was late at night, and the matron of the hotel spoke no English and had no record of my reservation and no rooms available, so I was out on the street to fend for myself. But this was what I wanted, right? A true Parisian, bohemian experience. Nowhere to sleep, with only thousands of American dollars in my pocket. So, I immediately called home and cried. My rocky start did at least fit with my movable feast-type plan to live in Paris and embrace my ennui. Embracing one's ennui is a real pretentious to-do. Sullenly walking the streets of Paris would be the postcard view into my faux-tortured soul. The second day, it even rained. Next, visit the American bookstore and buy Parisian poetry, preferably obscure, so I had it at the ready. More wandering the wet streets without an umbrella. Umbrellas are for people who have a place to be. I had no reason not to be wet. Again, totally existentialist. That night, I made the ill-fated choice to go to an American-themed bar called Tennessee, which was decorated eerily similar to Charlie's Eating and Drinking Saloon. It was pretty quiet, and they played country music, and I sat at the bar with my wet copy of Les Fleurs du Mal, ready for action. After about an hour, a young man sidled up next to me. He was tall, wiry, and very handsome, like a Jean-Paul Belmondo with long hair. He looked at me, and his expression turned to shock.
Oh!
I was confused. I assumed he was reacting to me being rain-soaked.
Bruilas!
He shouted.
Bruilas! Dia!
I don't speak French.
Mon Dieu! Bruilas! Dia! Vous êtes Bruilas!
I just nodded.
Ah! C'est fou! Dia! Jean McLean!
He was patting me on the back and sputtering drunkenly.
Jean McLean! Jean McLean!
His visage changed, and he quickly lit a cigarette, and then he squinted his eyes and curled his lips and brought a finger up to his mouth and blew on it like a smoking gun.
Happy 13, Hans.
Then he laughed loud, and it became clear to me he thought I was Bruce Willis. I do slightly resemble Bruce Willis. Well, my hairline resembled Bruce Willis's hairline. He then spoke to the bartender in French, telling him that I was Bruce Willis. Because it had gone this far, I just decided to be Bruce Willis. So I curled my mouth and said, "Welcome to the party, pal," or "Yippee-ki-yay," or some such line from D-Har. It made more sense, given the language barrier, just to be Bruce Willis than to try to explain that I wasn't him. Plus, he was so excited, I didn't really want to kill his dream of having met the real Bruce Willis. We sat for at least an hour at that bar, where the bartender clumsily translated for us, and I made up a story about how I was filming a movie in Paris and made up more stories about the set of Die Hard and the practical jokes I used to play on Alan Rickman. After some time, I told the bartender to tell him that I needed to go to bed because of an early call in the morning. The bartender relayed back that the man wanted to invite me over to his flat nearby because he was a young actor and wanted to party more with Bruce Willis. I politely declined. I was Bruce Willis, after all. I don't hang out with fans. We left together and stood in front of Tennessee, preparing to part ways, the Belle Epoque street lamp splashing soft light onto the cobblestone street. I gave him the thumbs up, and he shook my hand with a firm grip. Our eyes met, my signature Bruce Willis glare in his drunken, watery eyes. And then he pulled me toward him and kissed me, long and hard on the lips. I wasn't expecting it, so I didn't quite kiss back, but I was surprised enough to let the kiss last at least 10 seconds. It was my first passionate man-on-man kiss. I finally pulled away and awkwardly smiled. He looked at me as if to say, "Come home with me." And for one long moment, the thought crossed my mind to let him have me for one night, just so there would be some random young French actor out there who would have spent the rest of his life telling everyone he knows that he fucked Bruce Willis when he was in town filming a movie. But alas, I turned and walked away. He'll always have that kiss. So back to Five Easy Pieces. The 1970 film explores the story of an upper-middle-class family whose paterfamilias is a domineering professional classical musician. Jack Nicholson plays his son, who has fled his familial ties by rejecting his music pedigree, becoming a manual laborer/drifter, working on oil rigs and drinking heavily and basically squandering his future. It was essential existential fare in the tradition of the French New Wave. I guess I realize now that I related to it then because I was living out my own version of this story, but in place of wasting my musical genius and working oil rigs, I was just a failed fajita deliverer, staying at student housing. But now I was in Paris. Maybe technically not as romantic as Nicholson's character, but I was pretentious, so the bar was lowered. In fact, there was even a revival theater in the Left Bank that exclusively showed Five Easy Pieces. I would often go see it just to solidify my expat cred. So many levels of irony going on. My rebellion was moving to Paris to watch the same movie over and over again about someone else's rebellion. As my money started to run dry, about a week and a half in, things got a little desperate. I had moved to a rented flat in the projects of the Stalingrad neighborhood of Paris, which was mostly immigrant, Algerian, and poor. It was like a riches-to-rags story sped up to 10 days. If only I was defter at delivering fajitas, I would have had more money. But This quickly became the most thrilling part of my trip, mainly because the people there were the friendliest, even the hardened criminals. One guy, after stalking me for a block or so on my way home, came up behind me. I was certain he was going to rob me, and he said in broken English, "You think I'm going to take your money?" I stared.